Well, good afternoon, everyone. I think we'll go ahead and get started. My name is Linda Bosma. I'm the immediate past chair of the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Other Drugs section, and I would like to welcome you all to the session today and welcome you all to Boston and to yet another great APHA conference. So thank you, everyone, for coming. I'd also like to quickly, just since I have the opportunity and she is here, introduce the current chair of our section, Cynthia Hallett, who's here in the front. In her day job, Cynthia is the Executive Director of Americans for Nonsmokers' Rights, so a lot of you may recognize her name from that or from all the great publicity and PR we've been doing around the section. So, the session that we're going to have today is going to look at some cross-cutting issues and to some extent it's going to be a dialogue format in trying to look at what are some of the challenges that working on different substances have in common, whether it's alcohol, tobacco, food, to some extent pharmaceuticals. There's a lot of legal products that we work with some of the fallout from when there's harm related to it, and often we work in silos or work independently of each other. And so as a section, we've been asked many times, can we do more cross-cutting issues and present information on different topics together? And we've done some of that. But that's led us to want to take that a step further and to start thinking about, are there ways that we can work together across topics? And so with that in mind, we then immediately also thought about the context that we do a lot of our work in. And when we're working on policy, we're dealing with decision makers, and increasingly we're dealing in an environment that's very much impacted by money. And sometimes that's the money that we are outgunned by or out, you know, the other people have. Other interests often have a lot more money than the public health field does, but also increasingly we're impacted by the money that goes into the political process. And if we're trying to change policy, we need to know what's going on in the political arena. So today we're going to have three lead-off presentations, and I'm going to start by just reporting a little bit of information. We facilitated a conversation at the Alcohol Policy 16 conference a couple of months ago last spring, where we brought people in the alcohol field together to talk about what were some common areas of potential, common areas of problems and common areas where potentially we could work across issues together or learn from each other. So we'll talk a little bit about that, which got some of the conversation going. And then Norman Giesbrecht is going to present after me. And Norman is going to talk about, put more into the context of what's going on in the alcohol field in the area of combating non-communicable diseases, and what are their approaches in alcohol that might be able to have parallels or crossover or lessons learned for other substances. And then what I'm very excited about today is that we have the opportunity for a new voice here within the section. We have Jonah Minkoff-Zern with us today, and he's from Public Citizen. And the issue that he's been working on now for the last couple of years as the senior organizer is the impact of the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling and what that has meant for the way money is going into the political system and campaigns, and looking at some of the numbers and the information he's going to share may overwhelm us a little bit as to how big our job just grew exponentially in the last few years. Our opposition just grew. And what I've also asked is if he can spend some time, since this is a unique opportunity for us to have him here with us, and he's only here for the afternoon and came just for this purpose, so I thank him profusely, but also to make sure he gives you some information about opportunities to get engaged with that campaign so that you have some way to follow up with him and information about that, and our steps that we hope in the future is we can look at how the section can perhaps do some collaborating on this issue and taking, we always in public health talk about taking our efforts upstream, not just looking at where the bodies are getting thrown in the river, but who's upstream throwing the bodies in the river. And today we want to go one step further, who's paying the people who are throwing the bodies in the river. So so with that, I'm gonna try and go a little fast because I want to allow more time for discussion at the end, and we want to have time for conversation at the end. So I'm going to start by just giving a brief recap of some of the issues and points that we identified in this conversation that we had at the Alcohol Policy Conference a few months ago. And I and my co-authors, Norman Giesbrecht and Marie-Claude Lavoie, is Marie-Claude, are you? I don't think she's here yet. Anyway, none of us have anything to disclose for financial relationships. So, So one of the things that we often see when we do our work is, you know, right away we meet somebody at the conference, we network with them, and you're like, what do? Tobacco, food, alcohol. You know, we pigeonhole ourselves into which silo we work in. You know, and there's some of that is specialization, so we have a lot of expertise in one area, but some of it keeps us separate sometimes from each other and leads to a lack of sharing information across fields and across across different substances. Often we'll find that we have separate regulatory bodies that deal with the different things that we deal with. They may be legislated and licensed differently, and sometimes we just have expertise in one area. Our advocacy efforts are often similar, and of course, in many cases, we're dealing with very strong, well-financed industry, which is often in opposition to some of what we think would be good public health practice. So at the Alcohol Policy 16 conference, for those of you who don't know, it's a conference held every other year, and it convenes alcohol policy researchers, practitioners, and advocates. And we thought this was a good opportunity to convene this discussion and talk a little more about what are some ways that we could share information. I want to thank, we had three facilitators who helped us out in the small group discussion process, Bruce Lee Livingston, Robert Saltz, and Samantha Couquier. And then we looked at four areas. And for those of you who are working in almost any substance area, these are probably areas that seem familiar on some of your strategic plan documents, whether you're doing alcohol, tobacco, food, pharma. So price and taxation, availability access, marketing, advertising, promotion, sponsorship, and then building that local capacity for policy efforts. So what are some of the things the group came up with? And again, these are things that came out of these facilitated discussions. So this isn't like survey research, just to make sure everybody's got the context of where these thoughts came from. But we know that price sensitivity works. If we raise the prices through taxation or other means, we know that consumption goes down. We know that for most of us, there's a lot of these products that are very, very cheap, very, very easy to get. Often they have appeal for young people and are designed for targeted markets. Often the impact, they're really encouraged to lower income groups to make it easy for them to buy. And some of the messaging when we're looking at taxation, for public health advocates, often it's hard for us to get a nice, solid, soundbite, concise message. And we're trying to explain complex ways that tax increases reduce consumption and may lead to reduced harms and reduced problems. And to put that into a soundbite is often difficult. And the industry often coming back at us with arguments for why not to increase taxes often has very clear messages that are very concise and well laid out. So we get the nanny state or personal responsibility or it's against personal freedom, sometimes regressivity, that it's going to impact people at the lowest income. And so it would be very harmful to do some of these things because, you know, suddenly we're finding there's a concern for people who are on limited incomes. We did find that there were a couple examples where there was some good messaging that was pretty out there, you know, just laid it out. And one has been the charge for harm message from Alcohol Justice, where they're looking at, you know, talk about alcohol and talk about what the cost of the harms are that it costs. And recently, this past year, a successful tobacco tax increase in the state of Minnesota went with everybody came together under the umbrella of Raise It for Health. So let's raise the tax on tobacco for health. And those were both messages that were short and snappy and clear to get across. So availability and access. One of the things about most of the substances we deal with, whether it's bags of potato chips, sodas, single servings of alcohol, cigarettes, you can get these things just about everywhere. And they're very easy to get. So I have a couple of cartoons from a great new book called Eat, Drink, Vote. Has some fun stuff in it. It's okay once in a while to have a little humor. So, but anyway, you know, wow, isn't this amazing? All these monuments. Yes, there's McDonald's, there's Starbucks. And as we know, that's not just if we're walking around our own nation's capital. We see these in every country that we go to practically. Outlet density. Outlets everywhere. It's very convenient to buy things. Often you can get all of these products at one stop, which is, you know, just ever so handy. And then the challenges. We have age of sale laws for alcohol and tobacco, but it's often difficult. We just saw a great presentation a little earlier this morning from alcohol researchers who are looking at how difficult it still is to have enforcement consistently around age of sale laws and to be able to prioritize that. And as I mentioned, the different sizes. So some of it is like the huge bag of Doritos or the very nice small single cigar or bottle of alcohol that you can take with you. So, you know, got your bases covered. The other problem we have is the public isn't always convinced regulations are necessary. So when we have campaigns to try and put more healthy food into school lunch menus, we're accused of being the nanny state, and we don't want the government telling us what to do. But yet at the same time, if we're not controlling the message from a public health perspective, who is controlling that message? It's the people that profit off of it in one way or another. So a lot of times what people are really saying is if they don't want the government to control it, they're very happy to let corporations determine what those messages will be. Local control efforts are often very effective, but they can be difficult to do. Some states preempt having local policy that's stronger than state-level policy. Or there may be things like in alcohol, there might be statewide alcohol beverage controls, ABCs, so that you don't have the ability to do tighter licensing at the local level. And there can be complexity in these systems. So these are all things that people saw as some of the challenges we deal with when we're looking at access and availability. The other thing that we really run up in all of these substances is the marketing, the sponsorships. So when you look at your average public health campaign and what we're able to put into a social messaging campaign, our ads often are not the sexy, glamorous, funny, well-done ads. I mean, look at the day after the Super Bowl. The ads get just as much coverage as the Super Bowl game gets. People remember the ads probably longer than they remember who won the game or who was in it, for that matter. So we don't have that kind of budget, but the advertising is extremely well done. And on our end, you know, we're often showing really dismal things like car crashes or damaged lungs, or the, you know, people remember the This Is Your Brain on Drugs with the Fried Egg campaign. You know, not the same sex appeal that we often see, you know, with the Swedish ski team or different things that we see in many of these ads. And then the ability to really zero down and target that marketing, whether it's to the LGBT community or a neighborhood or an income group or an occupational group. So we don't have those kind of resources as a rule either, but there's very, very strategic and sophisticated targeting to different sectors of the population. We also have a problem with, you know, there's some great research out there, which hopefully you're seeing at the conference, but we know there are confusing messages in some of the research. And also sometimes there's pseudo research that, you know, it's like, well, you know, I would like to contract a study so that it finds out my point of view. And in the alcohol field, one of the examples is just a lot of confusion around is wine healthy or is wine not healthy? And of course, it depends on many, many different things. And, but, you know, a lot of people, it's like, oh, well, you know, a glass of wine is good for me, and then what does your mind do? Well, two is probably better, you know. So, but, you know, a lot of confusion around that, and I came across this, oh, red wine makes them live longer, but they get to be a real pain. And here's the mice, oh, it has a timid nose with the usual notes of oak and vanilla. I can't believe you're drinking Merlot. The other thing that we do in almost all these substance areas in working on these products is we form coalitions and do advocacy and mobilization at the grassroots level. Our funding streams, though, still often segregate the work. So you get a grant to do alcohol policy, or you get a grant to work on food and nutrition, or you get a grant to work on tobacco. There are a few streams that will work across substances. The drug-free communities works on alcohol, tobacco, marijuana, and prescription drugs. The community transformation grants are doing both nutrition and tobacco issues, but those tend to still be the exception more than the rule. The other thing that's such an issue for coalition work is sustaining that work. You have a grant, you do some great things, you don't get funded again because your funding sources change priorities. So how do you maintain the enthusiasm, the skill, the capacity, the staffing? So it's very difficult to maintain these efforts the way we currently structure them. The other thing is that often the funding that we receive is dependent on getting renewed by Congress. And when Jonah talks, we'll have a much deeper idea of why that can sometimes be a challenge. And many of us have known of programs that disappeared over the years, and you know, this set of initials program or that set of initials program that isn't there any longer. And sometimes there's work behind the scenes to ensure those programs disappear and are replaced. So reasons to collaborate. You know, part of it is that we have similar strategies. So often you talk to somebody who's working in a different focus area than you are, and you're like, oh, you know, that's, we do something like that, but we don't add that piece to it. Or when tobacco and alcohol first started to communicate a little more, alcohol people were often working a lot with law enforcement, and sometimes tobacco people weren't. And you see a little more of that, for instance, now. So strategies we can share with each other. We need that coalition work if we're going to do policy work. So we need to have strategies where we're mobilizing people in the community. So if we can mobilize on one issue, can we do more? Can we do across issues? And how can we creatively think? Because we know we're in a time of limited resources, and it doesn't appear that's going to change. So we may have to change how we're doing the work and how we're approaching the work and think about if there are creative ideas that we can bring to making what resources we have go further. And if you've been working with decision makers on one issue and have a positive relationship and they've been receptive to working with you on food policy in the local school, maybe they're going to be receptive to listening to your credible voice now. Maybe they'll also be interested to hear what you know about tobacco control and possibilities and the concern of kids in school starting to bring in all these new substances and deal with e-cigarettes, et cetera. So hopefully we can learn from each other, and one of the things that, since this was primarily a group of alcohol researchers that were having the discussion, one of the things that came up a lot is we have so many great examples from the field of tobacco control. They've been at it a little longer than the rest of us, a lot of different successes, and often, you know, sometimes there's a little competition. How come people in tobacco get such and such? And, you know, you'll hear me complaining because alcohol got left out of the community transformation grant, for example. You know, what can we learn from tobacco so that we expand on those lessons? The other thing is that often there is just the capacity for one group to be working at the local level. So they may need to be trying to do it all. So de facto, we may have a lot of groups already trying to work on everything, and we just haven't been offering them good ways to do it. And I don't know about some of you, but I've often gone into a local community setting and talked to them perhaps about one specific model program that they're doing around alcohol, and the person I talk to then starts talking about their work life, and that person's doing seat belts, pregnancy prevention, HIV/AIDS, you name it, and it's like, oh, and you're going to coordinate and run an organizing campaign on this issue in addition to those 10 other topics in your 40-hour week. So I think we have to acknowledge some of that already happens, and we can't do it all with the current models frequently. So some challenges that we brought up that didn't always fit into some of the conversation we were having that day. Prescription drugs are slightly different. You don't get them at a convenience store, for example. So there's tight regulation, but we're also seeing a lot more abuse. There's several really excellent sessions on prescription drugs at the conference this week, so please check those out. The other thing is that changing legal status of marijuana is causing a lot of confusion. And, you know, it's somewhat legal in some states, it's medicinal in some states, it's completely illegal yet in other states. We don't have solid research in so many areas of it, but, you know, you can't go and do compliance checks at a dispensary in the same way you might do around tobacco or alcohol, but yet we know we've got young people getting a hold of medicinal marijuana and using it for recreational purposes. So that didn't fit neatly into our conversation, but it's something that we need to look at, and it's something that our community practitioners are definitely trying to figure out how to work with. So the other thing is that even though there's similarities, we know that there's differences between some of the areas. For instance, in tobacco, we generally are talking abstinence and trying to, like, have no tobacco use. You're rarely talking about social smokers or responsible smoking, but those are concepts that get thrown at you all the time in alcohol work. So some of those pieces are different. It can be different for people to talk about their personal experience as an ex-smoker than it is to talk about their experience as a former drug user or a former alcohol user, for example. Food sometimes fits into these patterns and sometimes doesn't. And then when you have things like marijuana and prescription drugs, where there's a medicinal value as well as an abusive value, so there's, you know, some confusion that sometimes it may not be neat to combine some of these things. So those were some of the challenges in starting to look at the framing that we came up with. So in conclusion, People thought that there is a lot to learn and are hoping we can figure out ways to continue the dialogue. And so this session today is part of that. And what I'd like to do now is turn it over next to Dr. Norman Giesbrecht. Norman is from the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto, Canada, and has a long, lengthy resume of great alcohol research around community issues. So, thank you.